and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, we're at the 2011 Southwest Alaska Salmon Science Symposium, Understanding Habitat and the Science of Sustainability. Both professors at the School of Aquatic and Fishery Sciences at the University of Washington, Thomas Quinn and Daniel Schindler, were recorded on April 14th at the Egan Civic and Convention Center. We begin with Thomas Quinn on the strength and diversity of Bristol Bay sockeye salmon and their ecosystem.
Thanks a lot for coming, and thank you very much, Tim and Nature Conservancy and the other groups, for inviting us. I'm sure it's a brief trip. I had a lecture in my class this morning, and I got to go back and teach on Friday, but I'm really glad to be here and be part of this presentation. They sort of tell you in teacher school that the key to a good presentation is to say what you're going to say, say it, and then say what you're going to say. So let's see if it works here. The first thing is I'm going to pick up on the ball that Tim teed up, why is the University of Washington working in Alaska? And then after that, I'll talk a little bit about what characterizes strong salmon populations, some general kind of research, address the question of how strong are the runs of salmon, and particularly sockeye salmon. And I don't want to get fixated on sockeye salmon, but clearly they're really a core species in the region and in the state, so I'll talk a little bit about that, including some contrasts to other large systems closer to where I live. I know simply by virtue of living in Alaska, everyone knows everything there is to know about Pacific salmon life cycle, but I'm going to just kind of step through quickly the sockeye life cycle and particularly some of the features that are really important to the strength and diversity of the populations that we have in this region. And in fact, it is the diversity of habitat and the diversity of life history patterns that I'm going to emphasize, and then that in turn is really me teeing things up for Daniel, who will provide additional and very rich detail on the importance of some of that kind of diversity, and the concept of the resilience and the broad benefits to both the ecosystem and to society that stem from those, and also some of the kinds of resident fishes. There's obviously a very strong emphasis on sockeye, but the same sorts of habitats that provide diverse and sustainable Pacific salmon runs are also very important to some of the resident non-commercial fishes as well. So what's the UW doing in Alaska? After the Second World War and before Alaska was a state, the industry, the canners, essentially came to the University of Washington, because of course there was no University of Alaska, and asked them to establish a fisheries research institute. And the gentleman on the right there, Bud Bergner, is now in his 90s and still very sharp, has all of his marbles. You can see that the University of Washington is not going anywhere fast at this particular moment, but of course boats and motors were pretty hard to come by, and this is of course not just before I joined the faculty, but before I was alive, so our research program dates back quite a long ways, and Daniel and myself and our students are incredibly lucky to be the beneficiaries of the data and the program that we inherited from these people, and also it's our opportunity to provide them for the decision-making process in the state of Alaska. So from the very beginning, the program was dedicated to understanding the physical processes, temperature, ice, river flow, and the biological processes, competition, predation, parasites, that were important in the basic biology, population ecology of sockeye salmon and their ecosystems. And the idea right from the start was to study the fish as part of an ecosystem and also as part of a human community that derived its benefit from those. And it would have been really easy in those old days to say, well, sockeye are the money fish, we're going to count all the sockeye and chuck everything to the side. They didn't. They didn't call it biodiversity in those days, but they counted and measured the sticklebacks, the char, the sculpins, the whitefish, and now we have a real holistic ecosystem-based program. And they didn't talk about climate change in those days, but they did talk about physical factors, and they appreciated how important those things were. So they measured the date of ice out, the lake level, the temperature, and now we're fortunate enough to be able to look back on those decades and see the hand of climate change, all the complicated processes that have been going on over the last decades. Very, very fortunate we are. And I show my grad student Neela Kendall there and a boatload of reds. There's always been a very strong connection to the commercial industry, but also the salmon themselves and their ecosystem. So I'm going to step back from Bristol Bay for a second now to a report done by Paul McElhaney and some research scientists at the National Marine Fisheries Service in Seattle As many of you know, a number of the salmon populations in Washington, California, Oregon were listed under the Endangered Species Act, and the National Marine Fisheries Service is tasked not only with making those listings, but deciding when the populations are strong enough to be delisted. And so these scientists thought about what it means to have a strong salmon run. I thought I would start off with that as a way of leading into Bristol Bay. The first is just abundance. Is there a lot of them, or not so many? They appreciate, though, that the raw count is not as important in some ways as the productivity, the amount of surplus salmon that are being produced in the particular habitat. And from a fisherman's standpoint, that's essentially the sustainable catch that you can have over the long haul without cutting into the brood stock of the population, and most of us appreciate that. They also pointed out that the spatial extent of the populations are also important for their strength. You don't want to have all your marbles literally in one place or all your eggs in one basket, both in terms of the geographical area and also the diversity of habitat that is producing those fish. And the fourth criterion that they had was the diversity of the salmon themselves in size, in age, in migration timing, a whole host of attributes that we can readily measure and our research projects indicate are important to the sustainability of those populations. So I thought I would take a look at the Bristol Bay sockeye populations, kind of using this as a template. So how big are the runs? And you kind of hear this, lots and lots of salmon. This is Gibraltar Creek. One, two, three, four, five, six, lots and lots of salmon. But I thought I would provide a little bit of comparison with respect to the global perspective and then to some of the larger systems. So Gregor Gironi and a series of colleagues recently published a paper. About 51% of the world's sockeye salmon are produced in Bristol Bay, and this is averaged obviously over a period of record, but a reasonable one. That's a lot. That's a lot. And I thought to myself, well, let's contrast it to the Columbia River. So what I did was I took the runs of sockeye salmon to just Iliamna Lake alone in the Quijac system, just the escapement, from 1960 to 2009, and I compared it to all the Pacific salmon, all species combined in the Columbia River system counted at Bonneville Dam. Now, obviously, this is after the fishing in both Bristol Bay and in the Columbia River, and there are some salmon below Bonneville Dam, but Iliamna Lake alone produced more than six times more salmon than all the Columbia River system combined, hatchery and wild. Whoa. Well, that's a lot. Now, bear in mind that we're spending a couple hundred million dollars a year on salmon restoration in the Columbia River system. You say, wow, that's really a lot because those Iliamna Lake fish are produced for free. So I thought, well, look, you know, maybe people aren't going to buy that. So I dug in the data a little bit deeper. In 1965, the run to Iliamna Lake and its tributaries, catch and escapement, was about 47 million sockeye. You go back to the records constructed by Don Chapman, sort of the dean of salmon science in the Columbia River system. At the absolute peak of production, all species combined about 7.5 million in the whole Columbia River basin. So again, we're seeing about six times more sockeye from Iliamna Lake than the whole Columbia Basin combined. That's a staggering fact. So we talk about a lot of fish. Those of us that are living down in the lower states are really casting covetous eyes on areas to the north, and I consider myself incredibly lucky to have had a chance to work in this system for some years. So even the Fraser River system, which is admittedly not as large as the Columbia, but very, very rich in salmon and actually has no mainstem hydroelectric dams, has produced on average fewer salmon than the Quijac system. And I took the data from the Salmon Commission, and over the period of record, Quijac system is out producing the whole Fraser River Basin for sockeye. And that is an extraordinary fact. So abundance versus productivity. I just had my undergraduate ecology class, and I asked the students to get them the concept of productivity. How much oil is produced in Saudi Arabia? But of course, we're in Alaska, so I'll ask you, how much oil is produced per day in Prudhoe Bay? No, the answer, of course, is zero. The production of oil is zero. It's coming off fossil ferns and dinosaur butts. The production of oil is infinitesimally small. We're just hauling it out. And so if you're fishing for 100-year-old rockfish that are very unproductive, you're essentially mining them or sturgeon. Some kinds of fishes produce surplus offspring, and that is what allows a sustainable fishery to go on without cutting into what you might call the biological capital. And so short-lived species like salmon and herring can be fished at a higher level. And Daniel and his students have done some additional analyses. They're actually more sophisticated than what I'm going to show you. But at a crude level, the ratio, the proportion of the total run that can be caught sustainably is a good measure of the rough productivity of the population. You can envision a salmon population, very, very poor habitat that is barely able to replace itself without any fishing whatsoever. So you'd have fish there, but there'd be no harvestable surplus. So I got some numbers from, again, the Fraser River and Bristol Bay, and the Fraser River actually was running at a very, very high level of productivity, on the order of 75% or so of the total run taken in fisheries, but it's really had a nosedive since the mid-1980s. Bristol Bay, obviously, is sort of bouncing around ups and downs and ups and downs, but fairly generally upward over the period of record. Now, of course, it was a very risky thing to project out into the future and say everything is going to keep going up and up and up, and of course, that's unreasonable. But the point is the trend in this region has certainly been favorable over the period of record that we have. So the populations are not only abundant, but productive in the sense of supporting very viable commercial fisheries without cutting into that biological capital that's obviously so important. So think about Bristol Bay. Of course, you have five major commercial fishing districts. You say, well, there's Bristol Bay as though it's one thing. They got five districts as though they're really five populations. You go to, for example, the Naknek-Quijack district, you have Alagnek, Naknek, and Quijack river systems. Each have some of their own features. And then you go then from that Naknek-Quijack district to the Quijack River, Iliamna Lake, Lake Clark, which is itself a very large lake, and a number of somewhat smaller lakes, then down to a series of discrete habitats that as biologists, if we were wearing our hip boots, we could measure rivers between large lakes, spring-fed ponds, small streams, and beaches, and there are about 100 identified spawning populations in that Quijack River system alone. So tremendous diversity at a series of different spatial scales there. And likewise, if we went over to the Nushagak District, we have the Nushagak River and its various tributaries, the Wood River system, which includes a chain of lakes where the field camps at the UW have are located, and likewise a series of these kinds of different spatial scales. The Wood, Nushagak, and Igushik drainages. Lake Alekniik is one of the series of lakes in the Wood River system, and there's about a dozen or so streams that are tributary to that lake, and so forth. So you say, well, who are these sockeye? And so we start the life cycle with fish that are spawning in fall, and of course, being Alaska, fall might be as early as mid-July to maybe mid-September. The spawning occurs, the eggs about the size of a pea and the color of a pumpkin are deposited in the gravel. They will go through a period of embryonic development, will hatch as aelivins, will remain below the surface of the gravel. An important point to bear in mind is that they are on the order of 9, 10, or 11 months below the surface of the gravel. So in many of these systems, spawning is occurring in July and August. The fry aren't entering in the lake until late May or to mid-June. It's a very, very long period of embryonic development because it's so cold. That's their gig. They figured out that that works, but that also means that they are vulnerable for quite a long period should these things be altered. They then emerge as free-swimming fry, typically would spend either 1 or 2 years in the lake before heading out to sea, achieving most of their body size after typically 2 or 3 years, coming back, spawning, and dying, and producing the carcasses that smell so nice. So we talk about, as biologists, the life history of sockeye, and this is the series of stanzas in their life, the times and places that they do the things that are important to them that control their population dynamics. And we see that these things vary. What time of year they spawn, how many years they spend in the lake, how many years they spend at sea, how large they are, at what time they come back. And all of these reflect the direct influence of the environment on the fish, growing conditions, but also the evolutionary relationship between those growing conditions and the genetic makeup of the fish themselves. Because the salmon come back not just to any old place, but as we know, almost invariably to the place where they themselves were spawned. So after generations, each population is sculpted to the appropriate conditions in that stream, the temperature, the flow, the gravel size, the presence of pathogens, and so forth. And so as we as biologists go from stream to beach to river, we see the fish are different. We know that these adaptations favor their survival in those particular habitats. We can measure those kinds of things. And the diversity of habitat is directly translating to the diversity of life history patterns in those fish. So just to contrast again the Wood River lakes and Iliamnes just for a moment, if you went out there and measured them, and this is the sort of thing that our crew do, Iliamna Lake is cooler than Lake Aleknagik by a couple of degrees centigrade. It's clearer, has lower density of zooplankton. It is a different place in which to grow fish. It's not better nor worse, it's just different. And this is representative of the many kinds of variation that are seen in Bristol Bay and elsewhere in the environment. What we notice, has been shown obviously for a long time, is almost all of the young sockeye salmon feel like, in a sort of a fishy cognitive sense of the word, that they're big enough after 1 year of growing in the lake to head on out to sea. So almost all of them spend a single year of growth in that lake, head on out to sea. Whereas in Iliamna Lake, only about half spend a year in the lake, the rest of them spending an extra year though. So that is a difference in their life history, how long they spend in fresh water. And people in the background are probably glazing their eyes over, why would he possibly tell us this? Why could this possibly be important? Well, it turns out that the individuals that go to sea at a large size that spent 2 years in the lake were actually smaller a year earlier. And in fact, they stayed in the lake for an extra year because they were small. Now, obviously, they're not thinking it through. Their mother hasn't told them that unless you're 4 inches long, you better not go to sea. But evolution has sculpted, has essentially culled out those individuals that go to sea at a small size. And so in order to achieve a little bit bigger size when they go to sea, they're willing to put up with an extra year of mortality in the lake, wait it out, and try again. And this is a response both to the direct conditions that they experience from year to year, but also the hundreds and thousands of years of evolution in those systems. So for example, in Iliamna Lake, what we do as university students and staff, we measure the size of sockeye fry at the end of the growing season in September. And in years when they're relatively small, hardly any of them go out to sea the following spring. Almost all of them cycle around for an extra year. In years when they are relatively large, because the water has been warm, the competition has been low, practically all of them go out to sea. So essentially every year, millions, hundreds of millions of sockeye are making that kind of go, no-go decision, whereas just across Bristol Bay and Lake Aleknagik, they're essentially all going to make the go decision after 1 year, even though they're experiencing the same climate in that particular year. No big surprise to people who are living around here. This is air temperature records at Iliamna Village. Lots of zigs and zags, but it's been getting warmer, and I think most people would regard this as something approaching common knowledge. You can see this manifest in the date when the ice sets up and leaves the lake. These are pretty well established, so it has been generally getting warmer, and this is changing the life history of fish in these different systems. It is affecting their growth, length of time they spend in fresh water, manifesting itself throughout their lives, but in different ways, in different contexts in each of these lakes. It turns out that the size of young salmon when they go to sea doesn't simply affect the probability that they will survive at sea, bigger generally being better, but it also strongly affects how long they will stay at sea. The larger the fish are when they go to sea, the less time they spend there. And so, as in the decision as to when to go to sea, they're making the same decision as to when to come home. I'm kind of small, let's say you're a female, I'm kind of small, I can't produce very many eggs, I'll give it another go. And that female is essentially putting up with the probability of dying in the next year at sea in order to be bigger. If she's already relatively large, she goes back. So each year those really big fish that you see are actually big because they were slow growing. Because if they've been growing fast, they would have gone back home a year earlier when they were smaller. So you have the paradox of fast growth actually can lead to small fish, even though that seems rather weird. And so those Iliamna Lake smalls that go to sea after age 2 are more likely to only spend 2 years at sea, whereas those that went to sea smaller at age 1 tend to spend 3 years at sea. And so you have the paradox of the very biggest smolts producing the smallest adults. And so changes in growing conditions in freshwater and in saltwater can have complex ripple effects through the system. So in addition to differences between lakes, Iliamna Lake as a growing environment compared to Lake Aleknagik, we also have very consistent patterns of physical spawning habitat, and the fish in those sorts of spawning habitats are different. So here we have my son at the age of about 10, sort of generic small human. In a very small stream, there's a series of little labeled A, B, and C because they got tired of naming all the streams. B doesn't have any sock anymore, so we're left with A and C creeks. They're pretty small. Fish in those rivers are, again, sculpted by evolution. And so we see sockeye that are spawning in relatively large rivers like that Gibraltar Creek that tend to be relatively old, relatively large, fairly deep-bodied, bulky fish. You go to a small stream, this is Hanson Creek, where the water is literally averaging only about 4 inches deep, and even a relatively small sockeye will spend almost all of his or her days with its back exposed in that stream. This is not sort of an unusual part of the habitat, that's actually pretty much what it looks like. And they spawn earlier in the season, they spend less time at sea, and so come back smaller, they are slim, they are sculpted by the dangers from predation from bears, and also physical access to a stream of such small size. From lake to lake, we always see differences in the river fish and the small stream fish. Some of these are a consequence of these guys that you folks know so well. Bears, you would think, are killing salmon willy-nilly, but it turns out that they're highly size selective. Larger salmon are more vulnerable to being killed by bears, particularly in small streams, and they're a major force in the evolution of life history in these sorts of bodies. We also find spring-fed ponds where the water is very, very stable in temperature. It feels to us extremely cold in the summer, but of course it's comparatively mild in the winter because it's fed by the groundwater, so you have a difference in the temperature regime. You'll see differences in the timing of spawning of sockeye. This happens to be ponds near Pedro Bay. In addition, we find, in the case of sockeye, large numbers don't spawn in streams and rivers in flowing water, but spawn in beaches of lakes themselves. And in Iliamna Lake, we have two very different kinds of beaches. Some of them are groundwater-fed beaches on the mainland, which would typically have relatively small, fine substrate. To many of us working down in Washington thinking about salmon spawning in gravel and rocks, we would think of this sand as totally unsuitable, but we have very, very high densities of sockeye spawning in these kinds of habitats. And you also see fine granite sand in those habitats as well. Just around the corner in Iliamna Lake, you also have low-lying islands. The water is actually very deep between these islands. It might be 200, 300, 400 feet deep, but you have these low-lying islands, and windswept currents are sufficient to circulate the water, and the sockeye are spawning in fist-sized rocks. So right around the corner this morning in fine granite sand, or rocks the size of my fist, and some of the beaches it actually approaches bowling ball-sized rocks. And so there we have a nice female sockeye ready to spawn on those rocks. Again, most of us down in Washington would not think about that as salmon habitat, but in some years the island beach spawners alone can be over 1 million in this system. What's interesting is in addition to the body size and age of the salmon, even their egg size is sculpted. So those that are spawning in that fine granite sand have smaller eggs. The females will make a larger number of smaller eggs. Those spawning in these rocky beaches have a smaller number of larger eggs adapted to the particular incubation environment. So each of these populations is intimately sculpted by the long-term average conditions in addition to responding year to year, a warm year and a cold year. The males in these populations, this is not sort of a Chernobyl mutation here. This is sort of typical of what we see. These beach spawning populations, the males have extremely exaggerated bodies. It's a combination of female choice. The ladies can tell us why they would prefer to mate with a man like this. But they also use that for display, kind of my hump's bigger than your hump, and here are two guys showing off to each other. And dominance is established by this sort of show-offedness. So you say, all right, this is interesting curiosity. This sounds like a University of Washington lecture, but why is this important? Why do we want to have salmon using all the different habitats? The first is, obviously, if all the aquatic habitats are used, in aggregate, you've got more fish than if you only use some of them. The second thing is that these habitats, because they are different, some relying on surface water, some relying on groundwater, some relying on wind-driven surface currents, some draining from lakes, some warmer, some colder, will perform differently under different climate regimes. And again, this is the kind of point that Daniel is going to make very strongly in his presentation. But because the populations that are going up in one period will be matched by those that are going up in another period, the system as a whole is much more stable and much more productive, both for the fish standpoint and also for the fishery standpoint, than if you had a less diverse system. Finally, resident fish and wildlife species require full use of the habitat in order to live out their lives. And again, we want to step occasionally back from the salmon focus and to remember that those other organisms are extremely important in those ecosystems. So, for example, these are some Dolly Varden. They feed on eggs. This is no big surprise to people that fish using beads. It turns out that a Dolly Varden about 18 inches long can eat at a single time over 1,000 sockeye salmon eggs. This is an example of one that we've just sort of pumped its stomach. And even little fellows will eat large numbers of eggs. They'll achieve most of their annual nutritional input from salmon eggs and flesh and maggots that have been feeding on the rotting carcasses. I know, a bit of a joke around here. You know about these things, but the density of bears, the size of bears, the number of multiple births and the number of multiple births that survive the season is all positively correlated with the abundance of meat and especially salmon. So individual populations vary less, vary substantially more than the aggregate. And again, Daniel is going to provide much more detail. He's done much more elegant analysis. Just at a very, very crude level, I took one of the sockeye populations that we study, those little spring-fed ponds near Pedro Bay, and that coefficient of variation is a statistical measure of how much it varies from year to year. And the year-to-year variation is enormous. It is more than the year-to-year variation of all the populations in Iliamna Lake combined, and that is more variable than the Naknek-Quijack District, and that is more variable than Bristol Bay as a whole. And again, these are things that Daniel is going to hit on much more strongly, but qualitatively I think you can appreciate, because the rising tide doesn't actually lift all boats, we get a greater balance from having a larger number of populations. We think about some of the other kinds of organisms that we have here. And again, there's a little bit of a sockeye focus. Substantial runs of coho salmon, of pink salmon, those species also rely on the diversity of habitats that they have. They tend not to have gotten as much attention. They're not the big commercial producers, but they're part of the biodiversity, and under certain other sets of conditions, they may become very, very substantial. Across the state of Alaska, you're seeing changes in the relative abundance of different salmon species. Pink salmon are coming on in some places that they didn't used to be abundant. Sockeye salmon are coming on in some places where they didn't used to be abundant. So we need to bear in mind that there is an entire ecosystem that is producing a wide variety of these kinds of species, both the anadromous salmon, but also some of the resident fishes as well. Folks that fish in these areas notice that in some cases the rainbow trout, for example, are very, very darkly colored and heavily spotted. Others are very, very silvery, looking more like steelhead. People refer to these as kind of leopard trout or lake fish and river fish. These are fish that are displaying different patterns of migration, of life history, and are part of, obviously, the recreational fisheries, but also the complex ecosystems. They're simply not as carefully studied as some of those sockeye salmon. In addition, we have Dolly Varden. This is to get tremendous variation in the trout, in the char, in all of these species, and that's part of the rich biodiversity that we see in this area, a consequence of the variety of streams, lakes, ponds, and intact habitat. And obviously in the case of whoppers like that, lots and lots and lots of sockeye to eat. They basically eat eggs for a couple of months, and that fills virtually their whole nutrition for the year. In addition, we also find some of the Arctic char. This is in the Quijack system. This is Falls and Tizimina Lake. One of my grad students, Pamela Woods, is studying some of the Arctic char there. Here we have two Arctic char. The one at the bottom is 7 inches long. This one is almost 20 inches long. They're both sexually mature in the same lake, so you have totally different forms of Arctic char living out totally different life histories in the same body of water that have evolved there. And again, the diversity of char, the diversity of trout, the diversity of Dolly Varden, sockeye, all depends on the habitat being intact and the diversity of opportunities that they have to play out their different life histories. So I told you I would eventually tell you something and tell you what I told you. The sockeye populations in this area are exceptional. I think it would be fair to say that they are the jewels in the crown, not only for Alaska, but for the world, in abundance, in productivity, that is the sustainability of the fisheries, in spatial and habitat and life history diversity. They support the fisheries and an entire ecosystem, the bears, the pike, the char, and so forth. As the sockeye go, so goes the rest of the system. And their health depends on the full use of these habitats, connectedness from the estuary all the way up to the top of the spawning system, streams to beaver ponds, to lakes, to spring-fed ponds. They've had the benefit of good management, and obviously that's extremely critical, and also obviously the habitat. So habitat plus fishery management in this area equals sustainability. I have lots of acknowledgments, but I'll kind of keep it short. Most importantly, the pioneers of the Fisheries Research Institute, Don Rogers on the right, who is still with us, Bud Bergner and Don Rogers on the left, who is not. The pioneers there, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, who we work with very closely over all the years, and they're extremely good collaborators in all our aspects of our program. The funding we've had has been largely from the seafood industry in the earlier years, more recently from the National Science Foundation, Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation, and a variety of other sources. And of course, the decades of students and staff that have been collecting the sorts of data that we now could rely upon and share with you folks. Thanks a lot for your time.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with lectures from the 2011 Southwest Alaska Salmon Science Symposium. In the first half of today's show, you heard from University of Washington professor Thomas Quinn on the strength and diversity of Bristol Bay sockeye salmon and their ecosystem. There is a link to his slideshow on kska.org. In the second half of today's show, Daniel Schindler, also a professor at the University of Washington School of Aquatic and Fishery Sciences, presents What is the Value of Maintaining Diversity in Salmon and Their Habitats?
Okay, thanks for the opportunity to speak to you. I'm going to hit on a lot of the same themes that Tom just talked about, and maybe take a slightly different perspective. I think what you should have got from Tom's talk is that within salmon, there's incredible diversity, even within single species. And the question that I think we should all be asking is, well, right, what's really the value of this? I mean, clearly salmon biologists love their salmon. They will study them to the very end. And the question is, does anyone else benefit from it? Or is it just an academic exercise to go around and characterize this diversity? Like Tom, I'm going to talk mostly about sockeye salmon, although I do think the principles that we're telling you about tonight apply probably to any species of fish and probably to any species of wildlife that we care about. So I'll focus on sockeye and the spawning grounds. And one of the messages I want to tell you today is when we talk about habitat, when we think about fish habitat, the tendency is always to go to our favorite stream and look at it at this scale. Individual stream, maybe an individual piece of the stream. We think about our restoration efforts. We think about our habitat conservation efforts. We have this long history of focusing in on these identifiable pieces of habitat. And I think what we have gained knowledge of when we think about how the history of the Bristol Bay fisheries have developed and played out is that it's the network of pieces of habitat that that really matter. So it's the network of habitat that matters. Probably more importantly than any individual piece on its own. And to set the stage for all this, maybe Alaskans know this, but I think the common person on the street, not that you guys are common people off the street, but have this perception about what the status of salmon in the North Pacific is. So here I'm showing you one of several reconstructions of how many, these are millions of tons of salmon in the Pacific Ocean between 1925 and 65. You can see that they are going down pretty rapidly. So the question is, what has happened since 65? Who wants to say flat? Stayed the same? Who wants to say have gone down more? This is the whole North Pacific. Who wants to say up? Okay, there's a few more reluctant hands there. Okay, this is what salmon production in the North Pacific has done since the mid-60s. Okay, it's increased substantially. It's actually higher now than it has been in 100 years. And there's a couple interesting, I'm kind of crippled, oh, here it is. Couple interesting issues to dwell on here. First of all, what's in hatched blue here are fish that are chum salmon produced in mostly Japanese hatcheries. And what we see here is in the mid-1970s, there was a big climate shift that affected the North Pacific, and it became a much more productive place for salmon. And the Japanese hatcheries have captured a lot of this increased productivity. If you look at the dark green slice at the bottom, this is North American wild sockeye, and you can't quite see it on this scale, but total production went up about 2.5 times after 1976. And most of this is Western Alaska sockeye. So the message here is that, in general, since about 1976, Alaska is producing about twice as many sockeye salmon than it was in this period between about 45 and 75, which was a period of relatively cold climates and poor conditions in the ocean. So we are in a couple decade period here that is probably the best that salmon have seen in the Pacific for over 100 years. If we dial in a little bit closer, this is some work that Nate Mantua at Washington discovered a few years ago. But what I've done here is just taken salmon from either Alaska, so these are sockeye and pinks, British Columbia sockeye, or some of the lower 48 Chinook and Coho, and just take relativize them to their long-term average, which is the green. So if the dots fall above the green line, they're higher than average catches. If they're below the line, they're lower than average catches. And there is, in black, is what Alaska has done. It was well below average between 45 and 75. It's gone through the roof, and production has been sustained at exceptionally high rates for about 30 years now. And what's interesting here is if you look at the lighter colored dots, these are populations farther down the coast. These things have declined during this time period. Of course, it's coincident with lots of problems associated with hatcheries and habitat and over harvest. But part of the message here is there's a big climate signal in the number of salmon that have been produced globally. And Western Alaska has been in a very productive state for the last 30 years or so. And the fisheries continued to benefit from that very productive ocean condition. So let's drill a little closer down into Bristol Bay and revisit some of these themes that Tom talked about. And that is that you have a fairly small region that's producing exceptionally high numbers of fish. And part of that reason is because it's a very diverse, very productive aquatic landscape. You can see all these big lakes here. This is why there's so many sockeye in this region. Sockeye generally rely on lakes for their juvenile rearing. What carved out these habitats, of course, were glaciers. They left this area, for the most part, about 12,000 years ago. And the habitat that salmon are using is basically the remnants of what this glacial destruction was. Okay, it's full of till, it's ground up gravel. That material allows a lot of water to propagate through it, which is the reason why sockeye salmon and other salmon are so successful in this region. And to give you one example of this, this is a reconstruction of what the Wood River system looked like just after the glaciers receded. And what you see here, right here, is a moraine. So the glaciers were actually not that big, or to the west of this, they pushed out, produced a big moraine here. And this was the post-glacial lake. And then as this moraine to the east started disintegrating, the lake drained and restricted back. And what you see left over is this stream network that, of course, now is a huge component of the habitat that salmon have colonized, both as the streams and, of course, the lakes are complicated, provide beach habitat, river habitat, etc. So it's the glaciers that produce this diversity of habitats. And it's easy to think very specifically about the diversity of salmon, but in my view, when you talk about the sustainability of the system, you have to talk about both the diversity of salmon and the diversity of the habitat that produces that salmon diversity. And together, those two things make this system sustainable. And I'll show you some examples of that. So here's the successful radiation of sockeye throughout this system. They show local adaptations. They're just basically different organisms depending on what type of habitat you look at. Tom gave lots of great examples of this. And part of the reason here is when they're in these freshwater habitats, a lot of them are in small streams. You can literally walk up to them, grab them, measure them. You can see the habitat. You can sample the fish. You can determine how and why they're successful in different places. The other thing to appreciate is that even within a single watershed, like the Wood River system, not all habitat is created equal. What you have is a mosaic of habitat quality. And what piece of that mosaic is productive in any one time period depends on a whole bunch of things, including what the overriding climate regime is, what the erosional patterns in the system are. Because, of course, if we think about climate, salmon are not interacting with climate directly. They don't care about water, about air temperature. They don't care about precipitation only as much as those climatological factors affect the water that they're immersed in. And how certain pieces of salmon habitat respond to changes in climate depends on the structural features of the aquatic habitat. And of course, it's more difficult to go out and see what pieces of habitat are successful at any one time period compared to going out and asking what pieces of habitat are catastrophes at any one time period. And this is about more than just the media. This is the reality of just seeing dead fish. And here are four examples of sites within, again, this Wood River system where I spend most of my time, where we have four big events that would be considered major mortality events in salmon, and these are all natural. Okay, and the point of showing you this is different pieces of habitat are responding to different climate signals. So here's a stream. It comes out of the mountains up in here somewhere, trickles out through to this lake, and in the fall of the seasons, you typically get big storms come in and build up this big gravel berm, we call this Berm Creek, that basically blocks off the stream. Water continues to percolate through it, but there's no access for fish. And this stream will typically be blocked off all winter long. During spring snow melt, this stream will rise. They'll have enough energy to blow out this berm. By the time the salmon arrive in mid-July, they can swim back up and spawn, no problem. Well, here's a year where there was a very low snowpack that year, and the stream didn't have enough energy to blow out the berm. And 5,000 or 6,000 fish died at the mouth trying to dig their way through that berm. None of them, they all died with eggs in them, okay? So complete population failure in that year in a single piece of this entire watershed of the Wood River system. Here's a river down the road, okay? Different year, but in this case, the fish spawn in late August, early September, and typically it starts raining in Alaska in early September, and these rivers typically swell back up in September and October. This year, the fall rains didn't show up until October. The fish had already spawned, the rivers continued to drop, and what you're looking at here that looks like a moonscape is about half of the salmon nests in that river dried up that year. Okay? Different year, different time of the year that mattered. It was a fall drought. Here's one. This is Tom's arguably favorite creek in the whole system, Hanson Creek, and here they have to, the fish have to swim out of the lake across this little delta into the stream itself. It's very shallow water, and here their access to the stream depends on midsummer droughts. Okay, and Tom has shown that on years when there's very low midsummer rainfall, half the fish, or particularly half the males, can die just trying to get into the stream. So they're sensitive to summer droughts. Here's a lake that at the bottom right that is blocked off by beaver dams occurring at a different scale. The point is simply that you have this mosaic of habitat, and it's sort of contributing and having catastrophes different places at different times. So when we think about portfolio effects in salmon, part of that is produced by the habitat themselves. We have a hard time going out and appreciating what's going on in the ocean, but these same principles are certainly playing out in the ocean. And just one way to get you to think about this, here's one of the few things that NASA has really done for us over the years, but here's a beautiful satellite image of Bristol Bay, and what it's showing is an algae bloom in August. The fish are long gone, the smolts have long gone since this time. But it just shows you that there's structure in the ocean. Now consider where the various rivers dump out into the Bristol Bay system. You can see that those juvenile salmon are simply going to hit different ecological conditions depending on where they dump out into Bristol Bay. So this is just one example. There's lots of reasons to believe that the marine environment is just as patchy and just as much as like a mosaic as the freshwater systems are. Okay, so what we have here is a fishery that is well known, it's productive, it's valuable, and basically it operates here in the southeast Bering. And the reason I'm going to use this word portfolio effect is what we have here is the structure much like an investment portfolio. So fish that are caught in Bristol Bay are being produced by 9 major rivers, and then each of these rivers has dozens, if not hundreds, of individual populations. And they, of course, are using different pieces of the habitat. And the habitat doesn't all wax and wane to the same clock. And what you have here is much like your retirement portfolio. For those of you who have more gray hair, you're more worried about this recently. But the idea is that your return at the Corsis scale, which is what you can take out of the bank and go to Hawaii on, ultimately is determined by how productive each of those major rivers is. And of course, each of those major river productivities is determined by the relative contributions of each of these pieces of the populations in it. So think about your investment portfolio. You have your retirement investment at the top. You have a bunch of mutual funds here. Each of your mutual funds is a collection of stocks. Okay? Why do investment brokers do this? Why has this become the strategy for long-term investments? It's because we have very low power to predict the dynamics of any individual stock. And as a collection, they become a much more stable, much more productive system. And that's exactly what's going on here in Bristol Bay. So here we have a system that despite changes in, and we're talking big changes in climate regimes, we have a fishery that's been, that ramped up in the late 1890s and has been sustained for now 120 plus years. And in fact, the highest production has occurred in the last 20 years. You know, biologically, this is absolutely a huge success. And why has it been productive for so long? Part of the reason, as Tom mentioned, has been successful management, good habitat. And what's good about the habitat? What's good about the habitat is that different pieces of the system have been able to contribute to the overall fishery at different time periods over this 120-year period. And I'll show you what this means. Again, now coming back to what could this mean for a person who's reliant on this system for their livelihood. Okay, consider yourself a fisherman who can only exploit one river. Okay, and this could be a set netter. Okay, but let's say you're a drift fisherman who can only exploit one river. I'm going to show you data now for one river from Bristol Bay as it's played out since the 1950s. Okay, these are real data. It's bouncing around. This is actually a logarithmic. If this is the source of your livelihood, this is a hard place to make a living. Okay. Why is this a sustainable place for people who fish in Bristol Bay? Well, this is what the whole system looks like when you overlay all of the returns to each of the individual rivers. They're not all going up and down at the same time, so that what the fishery is seeing is actually the average, the running average through all those river systems. And in black here is what the Bristol Bay fishery dynamics look like. It's much more stable than the dynamics of its individual components. And the reason the fishery has been sustainable for so long is because it's high grading on this river when it's very productive, and it moves over and high grades in another river when it's very productive. When a certain river is in the tank, like the Quijack was for much of the last decade, fisheries are shut down, but the Egigig system is cranking along, and that's where the fish are caught. So these things are compensating for each other through time, much like a diversified investment strategy would. And we can decompose this from what the overall fishery sees, which is here. This is the same as the dark line I just showed you. We can decompose that into the dynamics of each of the major rivers. So that's in that next colorful slide. You can see the variability of any individual river is much greater than the variability of the aggregate. Then for the Wood River, where we have our best quality data, we can disaggregate the Wood River into the contributions of each of its individual streams. You can see the variability goes up even more. And then it turns out that within each of these streams, there's also biological diversity in the age of the fish, as Tom talked about. When a female salmon lays her eggs, they'll spend some time in freshwater, they'll go to the ocean. Some of them will come back after 1 year. Some will come back after 2 years. Some will come back after 3 years. You know, what's that female salmon doing evolutionarily? She's basically spreading her risk. She doesn't want to put all her eggs in one basket. All of her juveniles are not necessarily putting or are exposed to the same potentially bad conditions. So this is what we would refer to as an eroded portfolio. This is what the system could look like if you stripped out all the biological diversity and all the habitat diversity in it. It'd be much more variable. In fact, over 2 times more variable than it is because you have all these things compensating for each other. Well, this is still a pretty academic exercise. So how can we relate this to something that people can think about? And that the question here is, how does this reliability affect the people who depend on the fishery? And you could do this in a lot of different ways, and a real economist would do this in a very different way. But The way we gin this up is a very simple example where we think about the current management system, okay? The Alaska Fish and Game manages under an escapement policy where they use the principle of maximum sustainable yield to figure out what the optimal number of fish to put on the spawning grounds is. And then they allow the fishery to take all the surplus produced in any given year. So what I'm going to do here is show a simulation that dials out 100 years of returns based on the statistics of the system. And the pink line is about 10 million fish, which is about the escapement goal for all of Bristol Bay in a typical year, roughly speaking. And the green line is the long-term average production of about 32 million fish. Okay, given the variability in the system, we'll let it play out through time. And you see it goes up and down. And in 100 years, only four of those years failed to make the escapement goal. So in years where there's not enough fish to satisfy the escapement goal, there's no fishing allowed. Okay? And what you see is that in 96% of the years, there's at least as many fish returning to allow a fishery. Okay? Now let's take the same system, has the same escapement goal, has the same long-term productivity of 32 million fish, but now we dial up the variability to the level that we see in our eroded portfolio when we pull out all the variability, all the diversity in the system. And this is what it looks like. The long-term average is still the same. It's still producing 32 million fish per year on average, but the variability has roughly doubled now. Now look at how many times you fail to meet the escapement goal on a year-to-year basis. And what you end up doing is closing the fisheries in 40% of your years. Fishing communities may be able to withstand 1 year of no fishing. It's really unlikely they're going to be able to withstand three or four in a row of no fishing. So this is just what we hope is a simple example of how variability alone really does matter to people, at least under the current management strategy in Bristol Bay. Variability does matter because it's reliability that allows people to maintain lifestyle and income, basically, from harvesting fish. All right, so what does diversity do in the system for people? Diversity builds reliability in the system. And it's the diversity in the habitat, and it's diversity in the fish that are evolving to adapt to that habitat. And what these things do is they produce dynamics that cancel each other out and make the overall system more reliable from 1 year to the next. Humans benefit from that in lots of ways. If you can think through this process like a fisherman, you're more likely to have fish next year because of all this diversity in the system. It turns out that, of course, humans aren't the only animals running around on this landscape that benefit from fish. Bears, rainbow trout, etc., also benefit from this diversity. Because it turns out they also are stomping around or swimming around on that landscape, and they actually swim or walk or run and find the hot spots from year to year. You know, animals that are stuck in one place probably can't benefit from this diversity, but for a lot of the animals that we care about, bears, rainbow trout that support a $150 million a year fishery in Bristol Bay, are actually swimming around finding these hot spots from year to year. And Tom's showing you photos like this. You know, the rainbows, essentially all their growth is produced from sockeye. They have a much more reliable, and in this case I'm showing you, it's not rice, it's maggots. Fly maggots that have washed into the stream after they consumed a salmon carcass. And the point here is that these large mammals, these large fishes that we care about are integrating across the diversity in the system. These animals are not doing it randomly. They've actually developed behavioral strategies to actively exploit the variation in the system. So here's the Wood River system, and I'm going to show you some data here that are stream temperatures from across this watershed. All of these streams have salmon in them for most of one summer. And what you can see is some streams have temperatures down around 3 degrees all summer long. Some are up around 15 or 16 degrees. And all of this is occurring within a single watershed. So we call this thermal variation or thermal heterogeneity. It turns out that this is one of the most important driving mechanisms that produces the diversity in the sockeye salmon. And it turns out that we have a few examples here of where predators of salmon are actively exploiting the diversity of this thermal variation produces. So I'll give you one simple example. To predators, these salmon resources are really only available when the fish are actively on the spawning grounds. Another way to look at this is just, and this is in the paper that some of you have in your hands, is just the dates of occupancy in various places throughout the Wood River system. If all the salmon in this system had exactly the same spawn timing, typical run lasts about 3 or 4 weeks, bears, rainbow trout, et cetera, who had access to salmon resources for 3 or 4 weeks. They don't. They have access to salmon resources for 2.5 months. And of course, if this is the time period where they put on most of their annual growth, this is a huge deal, again, in terms of the life history variation in salmon benefiting the wildlife. These cubs were actually quite cooperative. They'd figured out their own strategy for catching salmon. They probably didn't need the thermal heterogeneity. Fish do the same thing. You can appreciate how bears might do this, but it turns out that little fishes also exploit this variability that's produced by hydrologic diversity in the system. You know, fish have figured out how to use habitat a lot better than humans ever will, independent of how many scientists you put out there studying it. So when we look at salmon habitat, it often looks like this. It often looks like this mess. You know, it's this very highly variable system. There's lots of heterogeneity in here. In a lot of cases, this is very difficult to study and understand. But the reality is it's this heterogeneity, this variation in the habitat, that makes it productive for fish. And part of that turns out to have really important implications, I think, for both understanding what produces a lot of fish in a given system, what makes them reliable from year to year, and also, I think, something we need to keep in our perspective as we move into this. We're moving into a future that's going to be warmer than it has been. We can guarantee that. Okay? In fact, climate change has already happened. Okay? It's already happening in a serious way. These are the dates of spring ice breakup on Lake Alegnagik. Since the early 1950s, there's a lot of year-to-year variation. But on average, ice breaks up about a week earlier than it used to. Okay? This is due to a bunch of things, but there's a distinct human-induced signal in here. Climate change is real. It turns out Alaska, Western Alaska, is probably the fastest warming part of the whole Earth. Okay? And this is going to continue into the future. We're probably going to be about 3 or 4 degrees warmer in 80 years by the end of this century. We're probably also going to be wetter. But one thing to look at is, you know, these are pretty maps, but look at the spatial resolution. The whole Wood River system would fall into one little pixel on this map. Okay? But yet I just showed you that there are streams that are 4 degrees and others that are 14. So how do we deal with this as we start moving forward into this warmer world? We can guarantee that this world is going to look different. It's going to be wetter. It's going to be warmer. There's probably going to be more trees. Some of this, and possibly a lot of it, is going to be more productive for salmon. But of course, what we'd like to know is, well, how really good or how really bad is it going to be for salmon? And, you know, despite being a scientist who has a lot of faith in science, my answer to that question is, I don't think we're going to ever be able to make very good predictions about what the quality of specific salmon habitat will be like in the future, unless things get incredibly extreme as they are in places like California right now. So how do we deal with climate change? Well, one of the ways to deal with climate change is the same way you deal with your investments. You know, if you could make really good predictions about what stock performance would be for 50 years, you would pick your best stock and invest in it. But of course, if you've tried that, you probably haven't done very well, okay? So what do? You diversify as a way to spread your risk, okay? So what does all this gibberish we've been talking about today do for you when you think about what's my investment here? My investment is in salmon, keeping salmon in the game so that people can use them, keeping salmon in the game so that the wildlife can use them, and in a future that we don't know what it's going to look like. How do you deal with that? Well, you spread your risk around. One way to spread your risk is to maintain the diversity in the habitat and in the salmon stock, because this is a way to manage risk as we move forward into a warming climate. And this includes things like keeping the habitat diverse, keeping disturbance regimes intact. You'll hear from a lot of people about mitigation for habitat. Okay, we can make new habitat if we screw one piece of habitat up. I don't think we can do that, you know? Natural landscapes are very unpredictable. They have a whole diversity of responses to changes in flow regimes, et cetera. And this is these are the type of landscape features that salmon do so well in. If you go down to the lower 48, and now we can look north to Alaska and realize, wow, there's lots of good reasons why our salmon fisheries are gone down here. And a lot of it comes back to the fact that we've messed up our habitat. And a lot of this has, you know about that overall reductions in the number of fish returning to the Pacific Northwest. What's less appreciated, I think, is that about 30% of the natural population diversity in the Pacific Northwest is gone extinct. Okay, so if we talk about a portfolio, 30% of the diversity in that portfolio is gone. The same species are still in the landscape. No species has gone extinct in the Pacific Northwest, but a lot of the populations that build up those species are gone. So it's a much more simplified, what hatcheries do is simplify the biology of the system, okay? And what, if you look at the history of fisheries that still exist in the Pacific Northwest and California, some of them are maybe viable, but the thing that characterizes them are these wild swings in abundance. They may boom for 2 or 3 years, then they may bust for 2 or 3 years, and then they boom for 2 or 3 years, and they bust for 2 or 3 years. And our assessment of that is it's just simply a reflection of this loss of the diversity in the system and the natural buffering that should occur because of it. So when we think about salmon habitat, we need to think about the landscape, and that's really my take-home message, and thank you.
This is KESKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Daniel Schindler and Thomas Quinn, both professors at the University of Washington School of Aquatic and Fishery Sciences. Just now, in the second half of the show, you were listening to Daniel Schindler's talk entitled, What is the Value of Maintaining Diversity in Salmon in Their Habitats? In the first half of the show, you heard from Thomas Quinn on the strength and diversity of Bristol Bay sockeye salmon and their ecosystem. Daniel Schindler and Thomas Quinn are co-authors of a landmark study on Bristol Bay salmon habitat published in 2010 in the journal Nature. Their combined presentation was recorded at the 2011 Southwest Alaska Salmon Science Symposium on April 13th. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on our website at kska.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to kska.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.